TNF soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hi, I'm Bob Baker.
And I'm Jill Hardiker.
And together we are Sound and Vision,
bringing you the best information, technology and interviews for the visually impaired and those supporting them.
We were very honoured to have a chat with Professor Michel Michaelides about his work with retinal diseases into the development and treatments using gene therapy.
Firstly, he told us about his work and his involvement in research, and also how he became interested in inherited retinal diseases.
I'm based at Moorfields Eye Hospital half the week, where I see patients with retinal diseases, primarily patients who've got inherited retinal diseases, both adults and children. And we see about 50 adults a week in my clinic and about 20 to 30 children a week. And the other half of my week is spent in clinical research, so trying to better understand these diseases, better characterize them, better identify ways in which we can measure change in these conditions following treatments, and then design those treatment trials and then lead those treatment trials. I've been at Moorfields and UCL, where I do my clinical research, for about 12 years now, but I've been involved in this area for about 20 years. The other part of my professional life is being head of clinical ophthalmology at Mira GTX, which originated as a spin-out company from UCL. So some of the work that I've just mentioned and those of others in the laboratory resulted in this spin-out company, which is the vehicle that allows us to do a lot of the gene therapy trials that we've done for inherited retinal disease. I'd always been fascinated with how the body works, which is really what drove me to come into medicine. And, you know, I like interacting with people, so that's helpful. And then just throughout my training, I particularly liked the medical side of things and the academic side of medicine, but also had interest in surgery. When I sort of listed out all the sort of pros and cons of different specialties and the fact I'm quite an attention to detail, / a bit obsessive compulsive, ophthalmology seemed like a fabulous fit, because there's a lot of medicine in ophthalmology. It's a very academic specialty, albeit a very small one. And there's surgery that's really quite sort of attention to detail, sort of minutiae of surgery. So that's how I fell into ophthalmology. And I was particularly fascinated with the retina, the light sensitive layer at the back of the eye, because it was the hardest to examine. And once I could actually identify it, I thought, well, this is amazing. And then saw some patients with very interesting diseases, had a couple of mentors that were quite motivating from a retina point of view. And then fortuitously, I decided I did want to spend some time in dedicated research and do a research degree. And there was a project advertised at Moorfields being led by Professor Tony Moore, who's sort of one of the heavyweights in inherited retinal disease. At the time, I didn't know who he was. I didn't really know much about the project, but I thought, well, this looks exciting. I'd like to do a project. And that was all on inherited retinal disease. And that was 23 years ago. And I found it fascinating and carried on with a passion in that field and sort of eventually got into the treatment side. And I remain fascinated. And I think there's a lot more to come.
The professor went on to explain about his involvement in clinical trials that disproved previous thoughts that certain children with retinal conditions couldn't be treated.
The publication of one of our studies in The Lancet recently was reporting a treatment of four children with a condition which is one of the most severe blinding conditions that we see that's genetically determined. This begins from birth. Children often have very poor vision in the order of just being able to detect light. That would be very common, or that they can see motion, or far less frequently are able to see a really large object super close up. And because of that very poor vision, they also have roving eye movements. So they have nystagmus, wobbly eyes, shaking eyes, and then they fail to, you know, fix on family members, recognize family members, get often very upset if they're left by themselves or in the dark. And this very poor vision results in other areas of delay. So they may also have difficulties in developing in terms of communication, mobility, behavior. It's not unusual that children who are profoundly visually impaired, as the children that were subject to the gene therapy trial, can also have autistic tendencies or have ADHD. That's really very common. And so not only does it affect their visual behavior, it affects all other aspects of their development and has significant impacts on their lives and that of their families and their carers. What was in the literature, the clinical belief, the dogma, was that these children are born blind, they've got no retina, there's no retina to treat. They've got atrophy. They've just got a hole in the center of the retina. There's nothing. You can't treat these children. It's a non-starter. Okay. And I guess one of the many lessons I've learned, but this would be one, is that, well, don't always believe the dogma. Don't always believe that, you know, famous people tell you that this won't work and I know what I'm talking about. They have no retina. And you say, really, well, maybe they've got some sort of magic powers I'm unaware of. But, you know, examining a child whose eyes shaking all over the place is pretty hard, right? You know, it's pretty hard to examine the retina in an eye that's not moving. In an eye that's shaken around and, you know, 6 months of age, you can imagine how hard that is, right? And also, what we've known for quite some time is that the way it may look from above, sort of a plan view, isn't necessarily how it looks in its thickness. It can look terrible and actually architecturally be all right, or vice versa. So one, it was really hard to examine, and two, we didn't have any really good data showing what was the actual architecture structure of the retina. And so I got myself hold of a handheld OCT, which is a scanning device that ordinarily you pop your chin on, opticians, those sort of chin rest based devices, and push your head against a forehead bar. Of course, you can't do that in infants. So you need, it's a bit like an ultrasound. We have a probe. And so you kind of have a probe that you put in front of an eye and you take a video. You keep recording and recording until you get what you need. So that was, we had to get funding in to buy that device. Then when we got the device, we started imaging children, okay, with this disease. And what we found was actually, no, they do have retina. There's not a lot, but there is retina and it looks pretty healthy. But by the time these kids are four, there's nothing. So that was the first myth we busted, that no, there is a window. This isn't entirely pointless and mad to be doing this. And the other big thing was that, well, look, they're so profoundly visually impaired, they're never going to see. I mean, it's just so bad that, you know, it's a losing battle. So what if you've got a bit of architecture? They've got problems in their brain. Their vision will never develop. They'll never result in formed vision. And again, that was blown out of the waters.
And we were blown away by how the professor and his team made such an amazing discovery that could change children's lives. He then went on to explain about the treatment and how the successes were beyond their wildest expectations.
So this treatment that was reported in The Lancet and then in the press was a genetic therapy, a gene therapy for one specific gene called AIPL1. Which results in the very profound visual impairment I've just described. And it's very rare, affects about 1 in 1 million children. And so the children that were subject to the study in The Lancet were from all around the world. Two of them were from Turkey, one was from Tunisia, and one was from the USA. And in addition to it being very severe, the period during which you can actually potentially consider surgery, and that there is residual central light sensitive cells present in the center of the retina, the light sensitive layer at the back of the eye, is still 4 years of age. So by four, there's nothing left to treat. So it's super severe, arguably the most severe. And the window of treatment, the window of opportunity is just 4 years. So it's very, very narrow. So it's very rapidly progressive anatomically. And so they've all been treated in one eye only before 4 years of age. They all had perception of light vision, so they could just tell if the light was on or off, or bright light shone close up into their eyes. And subsequently, they've all developed vision. So they've all gone from being effectively blind, inverted commas, children, primarily tactile. You know, often you'd watch them and their eyes would be closed and they'd be using sense of touch, to being able to recognize large objects, faces, play with their siblings, record vision on chart. It's by no means normal vision, but they've gone from just bare perception of light to being able to see 660, which is sort of the big letter at the top of the chart, if you like, you know, when you go to an optician. So that's a transformational change in the level of vision. And not only has it improved their vision, it's also thereby had all the knock-on effects of improving behavior. So it's allowed them to develop better language skills, communicate, socialize, interact at school, require less support at school, you know, engage with their siblings in a way that they wouldn't have engaged at all. So it's been truly remarkable, life-changing, and, you know, a real privilege to have been part of a team to deliver this therapy. And so off the back of that, we've gone on to then treat seven more children, but in both eyes. Why did we do one eye to begin with? Because at that point, no one had ever been treated. And so it was a case of establishing safety primarily. And we could compare with the untreated eye. In the untreated eye, the retina just degenerated and vision didn't improve. In fact, in some cases, it was less measurable than it was before over time. So given that it was safe, we didn't have any concerns from a safety point of view, and that the treatment benefit had been so notable in all four children, we went on to treat seven more. One eye first, then several weeks later, the fellow eye. And again, we had a remarkable improvement in all seven of those children. They all had similar tremendous benefit, going from very poor rudimentary vision to recordable vision. The best child has got to 624, which is 2080 in American money, but 624 in ours. So it's about kind of halfway down the chart, which again is truly astonishing, and had all those knock-on benefits of their behavior. When so much development is driven by vision, if you don't have vision, then it can be hard. Of course, there are lots of things put in place by specialists to help mitigate those for children who are visually impaired and don't have any option to try and improve that vision. But it's challenging. So this has had a tremendous effect on the children and their families. All seven have benefited. Again, no safety concerns. So we've now got 11 children that have had tremendous visual improvement after the genetic medicine surgeries. And it's been well tolerated. We've not had any safety concerns, which is super.
We asked the professor if there was any known facts as to how long the treatment would last.
I'd like to hope that is for life. That's always the promise of genetic medicine. If you're going in and correcting the underlying genetic basis, then you might hope that could be a lifelong correction. At the moment, we just don't know. We know that the first four children have had benefit that's extended to 4 years. That's the longest time frame we've had. We'll be seeing them again closer to sort of five and a half years. But to date, at least 4 years it lasts. Could it last a lot longer? It could. On the basis of another gene therapy for a milder form of the same condition, the gene called RPE65, we've got data that goes beyond a decade of patients who were originally treated with that in the clinical trials have sustained benefits. So, you know, time will tell. I'm optimistic there will be sustained benefit. Will it be lifelong? That's a long time, I hope. But, you know, even if it weren't lifelong, the benefit derived in terms of all the other areas of development will be lifelong, because it's such a key part of all these areas of development as a child.
To be involved in something so life-changing has had a profound effect on Professor Michaelides. And in this last piece, he explains about his feelings.
It's incredibly humbling and overwhelming. Whilst, of course, whenever one engages in a treatment trial, you want it to work, and you want it to work for everybody. But kind of realistically, you don't expect it to work for everybody, and you don't really expect it to have such profound impact, such a staggering improvement. It's genuinely almost too good to be true, right? So if you didn't know it was true, you wouldn't believe it. And so it's been helpful to get it published in The Lancet, and that's sort of, externally validated. But it genuinely is remarkable.
The professor's words, remarkable, for me, doesn't cover half of what's actually happened here. For a child to go from having next to no sight to being able to recognise faces because of the determination of the professor and his teams, refusing to accept the norm is phenomenal.
It's difficult to appreciate how much difference the treatment will have made to the development of the children, both in the long and the short term. This difference extends to their families and carers and the life opportunities they may have expected to have, which will now have massively an improved outcome.
We'd like to say a huge thank you to Professor Michaelides for taking the time to chat to us and explain the gene therapy studies. We'd like to wish you all the very best and ask you to take care. So until the next time, it's goodbye from the both of us.
Time for a bit of light-hearted poetry, which may not sound like it at the beginning, from Sid Oates, the South Yorkshire poet, and my name is Roger Brooks. It's called A Bit of a Do, or A Bit of a To-Do. It was a perfect day by the seaside. The beach looked so appealing. A crowd had gathered on the sands as children started squealing. I could hear the sound of voices getting louder by the minute. Tempers reached their breaking point, emotions at their limit. A mother with a child in arms was looking quite distraught as she argued with a thuggish lout. Her protestations came to naught. You could hear her screams above the crowd, but all to no avail. Then things started to get ugly, as they argued tooth and nail. I could feel my heartbeat flutter as the crowd began to roar, as he hit her square across the head and felled her to the floor. Then grabbed the child from off the sand, then whacked her once again. "Call the cops," a woman cried. "I think he's gone insane." In a minute flat, a cop arrived, his truncheon at the ready, as the woman got back to her feet, looking quite unsteady. Then the lout jumped on the rosser with overwhelming speed, grabbing at his truncheon, and he whacked him on his swede. Then a crocodile joined in the scuffle and grabbed the perpetrator, as the crowd were cheering loudly to big up the alligator. The sausages were flying as he dished out a shellacking, as he took the hoodlum by the throat, so send the bounder packing. I love a Punch and Judy show. They fill my heart with glee, entertainment at its very best, and everything for free. I know I'm just a kid at heart, but I love a mad affray, strolling by the sea in Whitby on a warm and sunny day. That's the way to do it.
TNS Soundings.